Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
This is an encore edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and live online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. At a time when the classical recording industry has been through sweeping change and many doubt whether it can survive in a new era of downloads and the internet, you might be surprised to find a 1,000-page classical reference book hitting the store shelves. But that's exactly what's happening with the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. Buy the book and you'll have access to over 500 complimentary audio streams, courtesy of a partnership with the website of Naxos Records. Joining us this afternoon is Ted Libby. He is the author of this tome and director of media arts at the National Endowment for the Arts. Ted, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the classical recording industry saw CD sales drop 15% last year, calendar 2005. There are also tons of online references, Wikipedia, Gramophone Online. Why now to produce a 1,000-page encyclopedia of classical music?
You'll understand if I say that I signed the contract for this book 11 years ago, before any of this was contemplated. Or perhaps if it was contemplated, it was certainly not in practice yet. But the point is that people will be interested in classical music no matter how they obtain it, whether they listen to it on compact discs, which I think still have some life left in them, or over the radio, which I hope has some life left in it, or on their iPod or via their computer. The fact that there are many streams available by which people can listen to music is probably a good thing, actually, and it certainly allows for a lot of flexibility when you're listening. You know, it's harder to take a CD player on the train than it is your iPod, and think how many more tunes you can put on the iPod. So there's changes certainly afoot, but the essentials of classical music are still, I think, very, very solid. It's an important art form. It's one that appeals broadly, and I think to the baby boom generation, it's got a lot to offer. And as we arrive on the scene, so to speak, you know, and reach our golden years, there are going to be a lot of people who are turning to classical music because it reaches them emotionally in a way that a lot of other music doesn't.
Well, so who are you aiming this for? Is it at the aging boomers? Is it at the younger generation that's familiar with iPod technology?
I think it's really aimed at both. I want younger listeners to read this book and not say, what a square he is. I want them to say, if they're interested in classical music, here's a book that actually isn't written by somebody who sounds academic or with his nose in the air. It's actually fun to read some of these entries. And hey, you know, I never had any idea about some of the stuff that was going on in music. I want, let's say, an older reader to feel that it pulls things together nicely, and that it opens doors for further explorations.
So you don't want it to read like an encyclopedia, a hagiography. You know that your little article on Pavarotti, gives him his due as one of the great tenors of our time, but then also gets into the second half of the career where he became sort of like a parody.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because actually I'm very proud of that entry. For someone who heard Pavarotti in the great years, and who loved the recordings that he made in those years. You know, that is a voice that's one in a million. It was really remarkable. But then to see what happened later in the career and the way that he let things go, and in some ways, I hate to say, but the disrespect he showed for audiences and for the art itself, I had to come after him for that, you know, and say, you know, that that he's really, you know, let's remember him for his great times, and let's try to just, you know,
at least acknowledge that there have been bad ones since.
Exactly. Yeah, and right. And so it's not a hagiography at all. It's not even really meant to be read like an encyclopedia. I'd say the key word here is listeners rather than encyclopedia, because it's meant to encourage listening and to tie in with all the ways one can do that.
All right. It's the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. The author is Ted Libby, my guest on Soundcheck. The cover art, you know, if people are sort of looking at the drawings, the pictures on the front and back cover, refers to a specific rhythm, a type of music, which we thought was kind of an instructive entry in the encyclopedia.
Yeah, this was inspired by one of the first entries that I sent up to my publisher, Workman Publishing, which is based here in New York, and it was the entry for the Barcarolle. And of course, there are lots of barcaroles in music. There's a particularly beautiful one by Chopin. There are others as well, the famous barcarole from the Tales of Hoffmann. And it was important to identify this as not just a musical genre, but to say what it came from. Well, it comes from the kinds of songs that Venetian gondoliers sang, hence barcarole. And the cover art then, inspired by that, shows, let's say, an 18th century bewigged musician playing a violin and tripping lightly across the lagoon. It's definitely Venice on the cover. And on the back cover, there's actually a gondola with a gondolier there. And these are all papier-mâché designs by Mark Steele that were created especially for this book. And I said, well, you know, who do you want in the gondola? And I said, let's make them all Americans. Let's make them some famous American musicians. So we have Lenny Bernstein, Maria Callas, Van Cliburn, and Yo-Yo Ma.
And who's at the front of the boat?
Well, that's the big question. I think it's me, actually. I think that they sent the artist a picture of me, because here I am on the back of a page of the book in a blue shirt and khaki pants, smiling and everything. And there's this figure in a blue shirt and khaki pants. And I'm betting that it's me, but I don't know. And if I ever find out, I'll tell everybody. Maybe it's somebody else.
But it's paper mâché, so you're just making a guess.
I'm safe,
yeah. It might be Ted Libby.
It might be me, and you can see I have my ear cocked.
Well, the book has this, you know, this definition of the barcarolle, which, as Ted just told us, it's the melody of the rocking of the boat. The gondolier is singing in this kind of lilting rhythm. And in the entry, you suggest these three pieces of music as examples of barcarolles. All right, now this is Mendelssohn from the Songs Without Words. Barcarolle. You also mentioned the famous barcarolle from Offenbach's Tales of Hoffmann.
This from Act 4 of Tales of Hoffmann, which is set on the Grand Canal, so overlooking the Grand Canal.
So it's a literal barcarolle as well as a figurative one.
Exactly, inspired by the scenery.
And then there is the Chopin barcarolle. Somewhat elastic rhythm here,
yes,
from pianist Marta Argerich, but you can still hear the lilt.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful playing. And yes, you can hear the lilt, and you feel that sort of side-to-side swaying that you get.
You refer to this book as the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia, so you are really targeting this at people who may not be, strictly speaking, classical music aficionados, experts, but just, you know, the casual person who listens to NPR. I mean, within the radio community, the NPR listener's sort of defining characteristic is curiosity.
That's exactly right. And that is precisely the kind of reader that I wrote the book for. It's not the NPR Scholars or Musicologists Encyclopedia. And if you are a scholar or a musicologist and you read this book, all I hope is that you will say, well, he got it right, at least. You know, his facts are there. His facts are accurate. And I'm, you know, a scholar might dispute a particular finding or a particular opinion, but the facts will be correct. And I worked very hard to make sure that that was the case. But it's really aimed at the listener who listens to radio, whether it's on an NPR affiliate or a commercial classical station or an independent public station, someone who likes classical music enough to want to tune the radio dial to it, or to have some CDs that they like to listen to at home or in the car, or who go to concerts, people who listen and want to learn more because they are curious, as you said. That is the character that I aim for.
All right. Well, now we have, obviously, a whole lot of public radio listeners with us right now, so we can open up the phones in a couple of minutes, and everything you've ever wanted to know about classical music but were afraid to ask... This is your opportunity to ask the man himself, Ted Libby, author of the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. Ted also wrote the NPR Guide to Building a Classical CD Collection. So, Ted, I'm guessing that, you know, a lot of the questions that you're asked are really basic ones, like I walk into the classical record department and there's a gazillion copies of the Beethoven Fifth. You know, what do I do? How do I know where to start?
That's often what I'm asked. And so on NPR, during the years that I was a regular on Performance Today, we had the show called The Basic Record Library, the BRL, and we went through the core repertory, core classical repertory, from early music up to the 20th century, which it was back then, and and we you know took something each week and looked at it, and then in the final year that I was there, we narrowed it down even further, and we had the PT50. We said, okay, 50 recordings that are really like the backbone of a collection, you know, really great recordings that really lay that music down as well as it can be done. So when someone goes and looks at the browser bins and they see dozens of recordings of Beethoven's Fifth, the one that I was suggesting that they go to first was Carlos Kleiber, the Vienna Philharmonic, which is was finally on CD, originally issued by itself. Not a very good value, but then when it was reissued by DG with his account of the Seventh Symphony, also with the Vienna Philharmonic, that all of a sudden made it not only a blazing account of both symphonies, but a very good bargain as well.
All right. Now, that raises the whole question of CD versus digital download. You know, are classical music people, are classical music fans the type who want to have the physical recording? They want to have the CD on the shelf as opposed to, you know, something that exists in the ether somewhere and they access it through their iPod?
A lot of them do, although I don't think it's anything like in the old days when we talked about our LPs as though they were our blue chip securities that we were going to retire on, you know, and that we would never let out of our hands. And the, you know, the way we felt about our LPs was you know, our prized possessions. CDs just aren't quite as huggable or as lovable as as LPs. But, you know, they've been around a long time now. You know, they have really stood out for the last 25 years as the delivery mode of choice for classical music. For one thing, you know, you get awfully good sound. With digital downloads, you may get into some compression, which for the audio buff can be a problem sometimes. Now, if you're listening on earbuds or headphones in a train somewhere, that's not going to bother you very much. But right, if you want to play them on a big stereo, you know, CD is still an awfully nice way to listen.
Well, the funny thing is that CD sales of classical music usually account for 3-4% of the total, you know, the total amount of music that's sold in that format.
That's right.
As a CD.
Mm-hmm.
Online, on iTunes, classical music accounts for 12%. It's 3-4 times more of a share of the pie than you get in the brick-and-mortar record store.
Which shows, I think, that once again, the classical listener is leading the way. Classical listeners have always been the bellwether of the music business. You know, they're the first ones you try stereo on. They're the first ones, they were the early adopters of compact discs. If and because they, generally speaking, have deeper pockets, It's something that sort of goes with the profile, if you want. So I think people who are interested in classical are willing to try new technologies and to adopt them early. So that doesn't surprise me at all. And, you know, when BBC offered free downloads of Beethoven symphonies a while ago,
Last year, the
response was absolutely astounding.
1.5 million downloads of the Beethoven symphonies.
Yeah. So I see this definitely as it's coming, and it will definitely be a part of how we listen to music, and I'm happy to adopt it myself. The key thing is that the recordings, whatever platform they're on, are still going to be there. You know, you'll be able to download most of these things once they've worked out all the clearances and the rights issues. Another nice thing about digital downloads is starting very recently, you're able to download things that don't exist on CD. For instance, the new agreements with the New York Philharmonic and the Los Angeles Philharmonic to make some of their concert recordings available as digital downloads. I think that's very promising and very interesting.
We're speaking with Ted Libby. He's the author of the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. And we're going to open up the phones and take your calls for Ted. Our number is 212-264-7483. 212-264-7483. If you've had a question about classical music, maybe it's as simple as, how do I get started listening to classical music? Or what do I do with all these multiple recordings of a piece I'm interested in? Here's your chance to ask the man himself, the author of the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. 212-264-7483. As we head to a quick break, Ted, classical music's one of the few art forms where once you hit contemporary times, people throw up their hands and say, I don't want to, you know, that's not for me. This piece we're hearing in the background, very pictorial piece, very easy to listen to.
Yeah, this is a wonderful piece from earlier in the 20th century, from about 1924. It's called Pacific 231. It's by Arthur Honegger. And it was written as a depiction of the giant steam locomotives that used to haul the sleeping cars across France. And the piece sort of shows this brawny locomotive coming to life, hissing steam and so forth, and then building up speed until it's really clicking along. Mm-hmm. And then the end of the piece is a very rapid deceleration, a slowdown. And comes sort of screeching to a halt. But the interesting thing is that he did this not by changing the tempo of the piece, telling them to go faster, go slower, but by writing it all out rhythmically so that the tempo stays the same and the values of the notes get shorter or longer as the train accelerates and decelerates.
You cram more notes in to make it
go faster. And this, of course, is a wonderful example of 20th century experimentation in music. And at the same time, it's something that you can visualize very, very easily.
And it's not scary to listen to
not
either.
Not at all.
Ted Libby's my guest. You can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. We'll go to the phones in a moment, 212-264-7483. You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. My guest is Ted Libby, author of the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. Ted, we went into the break with your suggestion of a piece that involves the sound of trains or evokes the sound of trains. I thought that that we might come out of the break with this little bit of music from Steve Reich, which actually incorporates the sounds, the taped sounds of trains.
Different trains?
Different trains.
All right.
from New York composer Steve Reich. Now, we've been talking about, you know, classical music sort of broadly and the way that people might, come to this music, might start collecting it, might listen to it over a period of time when the delivery medium is in the process of changing. Let's see what some of our listeners have to say. Questions for Ted Libby at 212-264-7483. And we begin with Dan in Westchester. Hey, Dan. Welcome to the show. What's your question? All right, we're having a little trouble hearing Dan. Let's see if we can try and get him. There's a question here from John in Manhattan, Ted, who wants to know, when purchasing a CD, what is a sinfonia concertante?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, something of an answer to that can be found in this new book. But a concertante is a concerto for multiple instruments. And so a sinfonia is just, this was an 18th century, late 18th century, early 19th century parlance. And it comes basically out of France, out of the style that was popular in Paris at the end of the 18th century and early 19th century. There are several very, very good examples of a sinfonia concertante, a multiple instrument concerto. Haydn wrote one.
Let's just concerto.
Yes, right.
I mean, if you're going to explain what
it's a concerto, right?
A concerto being is
a solo or multiple solo instruments with an ensemble that accompanies and that participates in a kind of exchange. A concerto comes from the Italian word, which means to agree. So you have an agreement, so to speak. But you can also have battles and wars even mm-hmm. between the solo instruments. By the time you get to Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky and others, you're talking about war between the solo instrument and the orchestra. It's all about who's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
Beethoven was the one that sort of let that cat out of the bag.
but a sinfonia concertante is more multiple.
It's multiple instruments. It's similar to the old Baroque concerto grosso, but it's more in the shape of a symphony. So you have, for example, Sinfonia Concertante for four instruments by Joseph Haydn. You have the beautiful, beautiful, one of the most beautiful pieces Mozart ever wrote, the Sinfonia Concertante E-flat for violin and viola. And an interesting, very quick story there is that Mozart wanted the viola to sound as strong as the violin. So he writes it in E-flat, which damps down the violin a little bit. The violin's much happier in D. And he tells the viola to tune the strings sharp, which makes it brighter. And so the viola gets to play in its own key. And then,
interesting.
It's a scordatura so that it comes out
scordatura meaning
I forgot what my tuning is. You change the tuning from the Italian word meaning to forget.
Okay.
So you change the tuning a little bit, and you get the viola playing in a much stronger key for itself.
All right, let's. I think that's enough about Sinfonia Concertante. let's see if we can get Dan from Westchester back on the line. You with us, Dan?
Yes, John. Sorry.
Okay.
Listen, given the name of Ted's book, the title of the book, I think I can anticipate his answer to this question, but I want to ask it anyway. The range of music that's played on NPR, in fact, the range of music that's just been played on your show over the last 10 minutes, makes me think that classical is a poor title for this kind of music, in that doesn't it refer to a period, and like Romanticism and Classicism and the Baroque, etc., and that what we're talking about here ranges over a very long period of time and styles. And I'm wondering if there isn't a better title for this kind of music.
Dan,
yeah, you hit it right on the bullseye there, buddy.
You certainly have.
We all wish that there were a better title for this. You know, the classical style, as you said, is refers to a particular period from about 1750 to about 1820. And that's capital C classical, at least in the way I do it. Whereas we're talking about small c classical, which comes from, again, another Italianate, this time a Latin word, which means of the highest and the best. And, you know, it would be nice to say that this is the best music. But then people would look at us and say, you snooty, you're stuck up in the air. It'd be possible to call it art music. And that certainly has some validity to it. But there's art in jazz. There's art in all kinds of music. So we're stuck, unfortunately, with this term as an understood, as a kind of an understanding of what we're talking about.
It's certainly a lot better than some of the other attempts that I've seen. The one that really bugs me is serious music.
Ah, yes, because we're never serious that much about
as if, as if no one else is serious about their music.
Exactly.
Our number is 212-264-7483, or you can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Ted Libby is here to answer all of your questions about the mysteries of classical music. He's the author of the new NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. Let's take a kind of a basic question, another sort of basic question from Sheila in New Jersey. Hey, Sheila, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. When I'm listening to a piece that I love, I'm trying to visualize the instruments and identify them. And I wish that there were a source where I could go and look at what a particular instrument looks like and hear the sound of that instrument so that I can then fit it in as I'm listening to pieces that I enjoy.
Mm.
For example, the French horn or the English horn, how do I separate the sound and recognize what I'm listening to?
Well, you called the right person there, Sheila, because that's one of the things we do in this book. I mean, it's not the only place that you can find these things out, but I made an effort in writing this book to identify the main instruments that are used in classical music. Here we go with classical again, but things like the French horn, the English horn, all the string instruments, the brass and wind instruments that are typical orchestral instruments or that have a large recital or solo repertory. And I show pictures of them in the book so that you can see, for instance, not only what an English horn looks like, but also what a heckelphone looks like or what a horn looks like, both with valves and without. And in addition, for the website that we created that was mentioned a little earlier, we put samples in so that people who have this book, they get free access to that website. They can go on and they can find solos for these instruments that are taken from either the recital or the orchestral literature. In some cases, for example, for the flute, I went into the fourth movement of Brahms's Fourth Symphony and took out a little bit of it, which is a beautiful, beautiful solo for flute in the final movement of that symphony so that you can hear the flute. It's just a way of helping listeners like you to zero in on what the tonal qualities of these instruments are, which you can't get from a book. You need to hear it with
right.
your ears.
Right, and that has always been the frustrating thing about writing about music is, you know, try to describe a sound, you know? So if you buy this book, on page XII, before you get to page 1, page 12 of the sort of, you know, the prelude to it, you get a registration number. Does every book have a different number?
No.
Okay. So you get this secret code, and you type it into the website, and bingo, you have access to all these different sounds that are kind of ancillary and auxiliary material to the book. The book is the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. The author is Ted Libby. And we'll let's see if we can squeeze in another call. Let's go to David here in New York. Hi, David.
Hi there. I'm Dave Renata, and hi to Ted.
Hi, David. How are you?
Old colleague of mine. I have a blog now at my magazine's website, and I've been recommending lately, and particularly in a review of a Radiolab program on musical language, that people go to iTunes or the Amazon website to actually sample pieces of music. You only get maybe a minute, but it's enough often to get a sense of style and orchestration and the vocal quality, all that kind of thing. And I was wondering if this is a good strategy if you're just starting out.
Well, I think it is, David. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I would do myself, in fact, if I were interested in comparing different recordings or even just in sampling some new work. I would definitely use iTunes or, in my case, Amazon.com. Very easy to access. They do time out after a while. And,
I think it's 30 seconds, actually.
Yeah.
But
it's still, it's at least a sense for what it is. And the nice thing about the website for this book is we have whole movements and entire pieces. So you can listen to a single link for half an hour. If it happens to be Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, it's 33 minutes. It's the whole piece.
All right. Ted, I want to squeeze in one more call, and this is a question I think that's for you personally. Lou, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John. I simply want to know, since you played the Art Honegger before, Ted Libby, who your own personal favorite composer of the 20th century is, and separately, who you think is the greatest 20th century composer.
Ooh, an interesting distinction.
Yeah,
all
well,
right.
It is. I would.
Thanks, Lou.
I'll try to jump around that one a little bit. But I would, you know, my personal favorite composer of the 20th century comes very early in the 20th century, and it's Claude Debussy. I find his music opened so many doors to what we call modernism, 20th century modernism, that his music was so beautifully written, so intriguing in the way it approached other stimuli such as poetry or visual art or just the attempt to depict the life of the sea in music. Here was a composer whose world of sound was so different from what had preceded him and so full of possibility for what came later. So in a sense, my favorite and perhaps the most important, but I would say on the emotional level, I'll stick my neck way out here and I'll say that Shostakovich may well be the most important composer of the 20th century because he spoke about what the century was really like in his music and was not so much interested in experimentation or in music as an abstract thing, but really still in music as emotional and personal communication, but a very, very debatable call for sure.
Yeah, but you know, he wrote under some pretty trying circumstances.
He sure did.
And through some pretty dangerous circumstances, so that's an interesting answer. All right. The book is The NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. Thanks to everyone who's called or emailed. And Ted Libby, a pleasure to see you. Thanks for joining us
today.
Thank
you so much.
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.